Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, we bring you two stories by D.H. Lawrence, the Rocking Horse winner and Second Choice. In my mind, Lawrence can write relationships like no one can. His characters are so well-defined, and the interactions they have are so real to life. Perhaps it's because he lived his life free from the shackles of civilization. As one of his friends said, he did nothing that he did not really want to do, and all that he most wanted to do, he did. He went all over the world, he owned a ranch, he lived in the most beautiful corners of Europe, and met whom he wanted to meet, and told them that they were wrong and he was right. He painted and made things and sang and rode. He wrote something like 36 books, of which even the worst page dances with life that could be mistaken for no other man's. And now, the Rocking Horse winner. There was a woman who was beautiful, who started with all the advantages, yet she had no luck. She married for love, and the love turned to dust. She had bonny children, yet she felt they had been thrust upon her, and she could not love them. They looked at her coldly, as if they were finding fault with her, and hurriedly she felt she must cover up some fault in herself. Yet what it was that she must cover up, she never knew. Nevertheless, when her children were present, she always felt the center of her heart go hard. This troubled her, and in her manner she was all the more gentle and anxious for her children, as if she loved them very much. Only she knew herself that at the center of her heart was a hard little place that could not feel love. No, not for anybody. Everybody else said of her, "She's such a good mother. She adores her children." Only she herself and her children themselves knew it was not so. They read it in each other's eyes. There was a boy and two little girls. They lived in a pleasant house with a garden, and they had discreet servants and felt themselves superior to anyone in the neighborhood. Although they lived in style, they always felt an anxiety in the house. There was never enough money. The mother had a small income, and the father had a small income, but not nearly enough for the social position which they had to keep up. The father went into town to some office, but though he had good prospects, these prospects never materialized. There was always the grinding sense of the shortage of money, though the style was always kept up. At last, the mother said, "I will see if I can't make something." But she did not know where to begin. She racked her brains and tried this thing and the other, but could not find anything successful. The failure made deep lines come into her face. Her children were growing up. They would have to go to school. There must be more money. There must be more money. The father, who was always very handsome and expensive in his tastes, seemed as if he never would be able to do anything worth doing. And the mother, who had a great belief in herself, did not succeed any better, and her tastes were just as expensive. And so the house came to be haunted by the unspoken phrase, "There must be more money. There must be more money." The children could hear it all the time, though nobody said it aloud. They heard it at Christmas when the expensive and splendid toys filled the nursery. Behind the shining modern rocking horse, behind the smart doll's house, a voice would start whispering, "There must be more money. There must be more money." And the children would stop playing to listen for a moment. They would look into each other's eyes to see if they had all heard, and each one saw in the eyes of the other two that they too had heard. "There must be more money. There must be more money." It came whispering from the springs of the still swaying rocking horse, and even the horse, bending his wooden, champing head, heard it. The big doll, sitting so pink and smirking in her new pram, could hear it quite plainly, and seemed to be smirking all the more self-consciously because of it. The foolish puppy, too, that took the place of the teddy bear, He was looking so extraordinarily foolish for no other reason but that he heard the secret whisper all over the house. There must be more money. Yet nobody ever said it aloud. The whisper was everywhere, and therefore no one spoke it. Just as no one ever says, "We are breathing," in spite of the fact that breath is coming and going all the time. "Mother," said the boy Paul one day, "why don't we keep a car of our own? Why do we always use uncle's or else a taxi?" "Because we're the poor members of the family," said the mother.
"But why are we, mother?"
"Well, I suppose," she said slowly and bitterly, "it's because your father has no luck." The boy was silent for some time.
"Is luck money, mother?"
he asked, rather timidly.
"No, Paul, not quite. It's what causes you to have money."
"Oh," said Paul, vaguely. "I thought when Uncle Oscar said filthy lucre, it meant money."
"Filthy lucre does mean money," said the mother. "But it's lucre, not luck."
"Oh," said the boy.
"Then what is luck, mother?"
"It's what causes you to have money. If you're lucky, you have money. That's why it's better to be born lucky than rich. If you're rich, you may lose your money, but if you're lucky, you will always get more money."
"Oh, will you? And is father not lucky?"
"Very unlucky, I should say," she said bitterly. The boy watched her with unsure eyes.
"Why?"
he asked.
"I don't know. Nobody ever knows why one person is lucky and another unlucky."
"Don't they? Nobody at all? Does nobody know?"
"Perhaps God, but he never tells."
"He ought to, then. And aren't you lucky either, mother?"
"I can't be, if I married an unlucky husband."
"By yourself, aren't you?"
"I used to think I was, before I married. Now I think I'm very unlucky indeed."
"Why?"
"Well, never mind. Perhaps I'm not really," she said.
The child looked at her to see if she meant it. But he saw by the lines of her mouth that she was only trying to hide something from him.
"Well, anyhow," he said stoutly, "I am a lucky person."
"Why?" said his mother with a sudden laugh. He stared at her. He didn't even know why he had said it.
"God told me,"
he asserted, brazing it out.
"I hope he did, dear," she said, again with a laugh, but rather bitter.
"He did, mother."
"Excellent," said the mother, using one of her husband's exclamations. The boy saw she did not believe him, or rather that she paid no attention to his assertion. This angered him somewhat and made him want to compel her attention. He went off by himself, vaguely, in a childish way, seeking for the clue to luck. Absorbed, taking no heed of others, he went about with a sort of stealth, seeking inwardly for luck. He wanted luck. He wanted it. He wanted it. When the two girls were playing dolls in the nursery, he would sit on his big rocking horse, charging madly into space, with a frenzy that made the little girls peer at him uneasily. Wildly the horse careened, the waving dark hair of the boy tossed, his eyes had a strange glare in them. The little girls dared not speak to him. When he had ridden to the end of his mad little journey, he climbed down and stood in front of his rocking horse, staring fixedly into its lowered face. Its red mouth was slightly open. Its big eye was wide and glassy bright.
"Now," he would silently command the snorting steed, "now take me to where there is luck. Now take me."
And he would slash the horse on the neck with the little whip he had asked Uncle Oscar for. He knew the horse could take him to where there was luck, if only he forced it. So he would mount again and start on his furious ride, hoping to get there at last.
"You'll break your horse, Paul," said the nurse.
"He's always riding like that. I wish he'd leave off," said his older sister, Joan.
but he only glared down on them in silence. Nurse gave him up. She could make nothing of him. Anyhow, he was growing beyond her. One day, his mother and his Uncle Oscar came in when he was on one of his furious rides. He did not speak to them.
"Hello, young jockey. Riding a winner?" said his uncle.
"Aren't you growing too big for a rocking horse? You're not a very little boy any longer, you know," said his mother. But Paul only gave a blue glare from his big, rather close-set eyes. He would speak to nobody when he was in full tilt. His mother watched him with an anxious expression on her face. At last he suddenly stopped forcing his horse into the mechanical gallop and slid down.
"Well, I got there,"
he announced fiercely, his blue eyes still flaring and his sturdy long legs straddling apart.
"Where did you get to?" asked his mother.
"Where I wanted to go," he flared back at her.
"That's right, son," said Uncle Oscar. "Don't you stop till you get there. What's the horse's name?"
"He doesn't have a name," said the boy.
"Gets on without all right?"
asked the uncle.
"Well, he has different names. He was called Sansovino last week."
"Sansovino, eh? Won the Ascot. How did you know this name?"
"He always talks about horse races with Bassett," said Joan.
The uncle was delighted to find that his small nephew was posted with all the racing news. Bassett, the young gardener who had been wounded in the left foot in the war, had got his present job through Oscar Cresswell, whose batman he had been, was a perfect blade of the turf. He lived in the racing events, and the small boy lived with him. Oscar Cresswell got it all from Bassett.
"Master Paul comes and asks me, so I can't do more than tell him, sir," said Bassett,
his face terribly serious, as if he were speaking of religious matters.
"And does he ever put anything on a horse he fancies?" "Well, I don't want to give him away. He's a young sport, a fine sport, sir. Would you mind asking him himself? He sort of takes a pleasure in it, and perhaps he'd feel I was giving him away, sir, if you don't mind."
Bassett was serious as a church. The uncle went back to his nephew and took him off for a ride in the car.
"Say, Paul, old man, do you ever put anything on a horse?" the uncle asked.
The boy watched the handsome man closely.
"Why, do you think I oughtn't to?" he parried.
"Not a bit of it. I thought perhaps you might give me a tip for the Lincoln."
The car sped up into the country, going down to Uncle Oscar's place in Hampshire.
"Honor bright?" said the nephew.
"Honor bright, son," said the uncle.
"Well then, Daffodil."
"Daffodil? I doubt it, sonny. What about Mirza?"
"I only know the winner," said the boy. "That's Daffodil."
"Daffodil, eh?"
There was a pause. Daffodil was an obscure horse, comparatively.
"Uncle!"
"Yes, son?"
"You won't let it go any further, will you? I promised Bassett."
"Bassett be damned, old man. What's he got to do with it?"
"We're partners. We've been partners from the first. Uncle, he lent me my first 5 shillings, which I lost. I promised him, honor bright, it was only between me and him. Only you gave me that 10-shilling note I started winning with, so I thought you were lucky. You won't let it go any further, will you?"
The boy gazed at his uncle from those big, hot blue eyes, set rather close together. The uncle stirred and laughed uneasily.
"Right you are, son. I'll keep your tip private. How much are you putting on him?"
"All except 20 pounds, said the boy. "I keep that in reserve."
The uncle thought it a good joke.
"You keep 20 pounds in reserve, do you? You young romancer. What are you betting, then?"
"I'm betting 300, said the boy gravely. "But it's between you and me, Uncle Oscar. Honor bright?"
"It's between you and me, all right, you young Nat Gold," he said, laughing. "But where's your 300?
"Bassett keeps it for me. We're partners."
"You are you? And what is Bassett putting on Daffodil?
He won't go quite as high as I do, I expect. Perhaps he'll go 150.
What, pennies?
Laughed the uncle.
Pounds, said the child with a surprised look at his uncle. Bassett keeps a bigger reserve than I do.
Between wonder and amusement, Uncle Oscar was silent. He pursued the matter no further, but he determined to take his nephew with him to the Lincoln races.
Now, son, he said, I'm putting 20 on Mirza, and I'll put 5 on for you in any horse you fancy. What's your pick?
Daffodil, Uncle.
No, not the 5er on Daffodil.
I should if it was my own 5er, said the child.
Good, good, right you are. A 5er for me and a 5er for you on Daffodil.
The child had never been to a race meeting before, and his eyes were blue fire. He pursed his mouth tight and watched. A Frenchman just in front had put his money on Lancelot. Wild with excitement, he flayed his arms up and down, yelling,
Lancelot, Lancelot,
in his French accent. Daffodil came in first, Lancelot second, Mirza third. The child, flushed and with eyes blazing, was curiously serene. His uncle brought him 4 5-pound notes, 4-1.
What am I to do with these?
He cried, waving them before the boy's eyes.
I suppose we'll talk to Bassett, said the boy. I expect I'll have 1,500 now, and 20 in reserve, and this 20.
His uncle studied him for some moments.
Look here, son, he said. You're not serious about Bassett and that 1,500, are you?
Yes, I am. But it's between you and me, Uncle. Honor bright?
Honor bright, all right, son. But I must talk to Bassett.
If you'd like to be a partner, Uncle, with Bassett and me, we could all be partners. Only you'd have to promise, honor bright, Uncle, not to let it go beyond us three. Bassett and I are lucky, and you must be lucky, because it was your 10 shillings I started winning with.
Uncle Oscar took both Bassett and Paul into Richmond Park for an afternoon, and there they talked.
It's like this, you see, sir, Bassett said. Master Paul would get me talking about racing events, spinning yarns, you know, sir, and he was always keen on knowing if I'd made or if I'd lost. It's about a year since now that I put 5 shillings on Blush of Dawn for him, and we lost. Then the luck turned, with that 10 shillings he had from you. That we put on Singalese, and since that time it's been pretty steady, all things considered. What do you say, Master Paul?
We're all right when we're sure, said Paul. It's when we're not quite sure that we go down.
Oh, but we're careful then, said Bassett. But when are you sure?
Smiled Uncle Oscar.
It's Master Paul, sir,
said Bassett in a secret religious voice.
It's as if he had it from heaven. Like Daffodil, now for the Lincoln. That was as sure as eggs.
Did you put anything on Daffodil?
Asked Oscar Cresswell.
Yes, sir, I made my bid.
And my nephew?
Bassett was obstinately silent, looking at Paul.
I made 1,200, didn't I, Bassett? I told Uncle I was putting 300 on Daffodil.
That's right, said Bassett, nodding. But where's the money?
Asked the uncle.
I keep it safe locked up, sir. Master Paul, he can have it any minute he likes to ask for it.
What, 1,500 pounds?
And 20, and 40, that is, with the 20 he made on the course.
It's amazing, said the uncle.
If Master Paul offers you to be partners, sir, I would if I were you. If you'll excuse me, said Bassett.
Oscar Cresswell thought about it.
I'll see the money, he said.
They drove home again, and sure enough, Bassett came round to the garden house with 1,500 pounds in notes. The 20 pounds reserve was left with Joe Glee in the turf commission deposit.
You see, it's all right, Uncle, when I'm sure. Then we go strong, for all we're worth, don't we, Bassett?
We do that, Mr. Paul.
And when are you sure?
said the uncle, laughing.
Oh, well, sometimes I'm absolutely sure, like Daffodil, said the boy. And sometimes I have an idea, and sometimes I haven't even an idea, have I, Basset? Then we're careful, because we mostly go down.
You do you? And when you're sure, like Daffodil, what makes you sure, Sonny?
Oh, well, I don't know, said the boy uneasily. I'm sure you know, Uncle. That's all.
It's as if he had it from heaven, sir, Basset reiterated. I should say so, said the uncle.
But he became a partner, and when the ledger was coming on, Paul was sure about Lively Spark, which was a quite inconsiderable horse. The boy insisted on putting 1,000 on the horse. Basset went for 500, and Oscar Cresswell, 200. Lively Spark came in first, and the betting had been 10-1 against him. Paul had made 10,000.
You see, he said, I was absolutely sure of him.
Even Oscar Cresswell had cleared 2,000.
Look here, son, he said. This sort of thing makes me nervous.
It needn't, Uncle. Perhaps I shan't be sure again for a long time.
But what are you going to do with your money? Asked the uncle.
Of course, said the boy. I started it for mother. She said she had no luck, because father is unlucky. So I thought if I was lucky, it might stop whispering.
What might stop whispering?
Our house. I hate our house for whispering.
What does it whisper?
Why, the boy fidgeted. Why, I don't know. But it's always short of money, you know, Uncle.
I know it, son. I know it.
You know people send Mother writs, don't you, Uncle?
I'm afraid I do, said the uncle.
And then the house whispers, like people laughing at you behind your back. It's awful, that is. I thought if I was lucky...
You might stop it, added the uncle.
The boy watched him with big blue eyes that had an uncanny cold fire in them, and he said never a word.
Well, then, said the uncle, what are we doing?
I shouldn't like mother to know I was lucky, said the boy.
Well, why not, son?
She'd stop me.
I don't think she would.
Oh, and the boy writhed in an odd way. I don't want her to know, Uncle.
All right, son, we'll manage it without her knowing.
They managed it very easily. Paul, at the other's suggestion, handed over £5,000 to his uncle, who deposited it with the family lawyer, who was then to inform Paul's mother that a relative had put £5,000 into his hands, which sum was to be paid out £1,000 at a time on the mother's birthday for the next 5 years.
So she'll have a birthday present of £1,000 for 5 successive years, said Uncle Oscar. I hope it won't make it all the harder for her later.
Paul's mother had her birthday in November. The house had been whispering worse than ever lately, and even in spite of his luck, Paul could not bear up against it. He was very anxious to see the effect of the birthday letter, telling his mother about the £1,000. When there were no visitors, Paul now took his meals with his parents, as he was beyond the nursery control. His mother went into town nearly every day. She had discovered that she had an odd knack of sketching furs and dress materials, so she worked secretly in the studio of a friend who was the chief artist for the leading drapers. She drew the figures of ladies in furs and ladies in silk and sequins for the newspaper advertisements. This young woman artist earned several £1,000 a year, but Paul's mother only made several hundreds, and she was again dissatisfied. She so wanted to be first in something, and she did not succeed, even in making sketches for drapery advertisements. She was down to breakfast on the morning of her birthday. Paul watched her face as she read her letters. He knew the lawyer's letter. As his mother read it, her face hardened and became more expressionless. Then a cold, determined look came on her mouth. She hid the letter under the pile of others and said not a word about it.
D-
Didn't you have something nice in the post for your birthday, Mother? Said Paul.
Quite moderately nice, she said, her voice cold and hard and absent. She went away to town without saying more. But in the afternoon, Uncle Oscar appeared. He said Paul's mother had had a long interview with the lawyer, asking if the whole 5,000 could not be advanced at once, as she was in debt.
What do you think, Uncle? Said the boy.
I'll leave it to you, son.
Oh, let her have it, then. We can get some more with the other, said the boy.
A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, laddie, said Uncle Oscar.
But I'm sure to know for the Grand National or the Lincolnshire or else the Derby. I'm sure to know for one of them, said Paul.
So Uncle Oscar signed the agreement, and Paul's mother touched the whole 5,000. Then something very curious happened. The voices in the house suddenly went mad, like a chorus of frogs on a spring evening. There were certain new furnishings, and Paul had a tutor. He was really going to Eton, his father's school, in the following autumn. There were flowers in the winter, and a blossoming of the luxury Paul's mother had been used to. And yet the voices in the house, behind the sprays of mimosa and almond blossom, and from under the piles of iridescent cushions, simply trilled and screamed in a sort of ecstasy.
There must be more money. There must be more money. Oh, there must be more money. Oh, now, 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 there must be more money. More than ever, more than ever.
It frightened Paul terribly. He studied away at his Latin and Greek with his tutor, but his intense hours were spent with Bassett. The Grand National had gone by. He had not known, and had lost 100 pounds. Summer was at hand. He was in agony for the Lincoln. But even for the Lincoln he did not know, and he lost 50 pounds. He became wild-eyed and strange, as if something were going to explode in him.
"Let it alone, son. Don't you bother about it,"
urged Uncle Oscar. But it was as if the boy couldn't really hear what his uncle was saying.
"I've got to know for the Derby! I've got to know for the Derby!"
the child reiterated, his big blue eyes blazing with a sort of madness. His mother noticed how overwrought he was.
"You'd better go to the seaside. Wouldn't you like to go now to the seaside instead of waiting? I think you'd better," she said, looking down at him anxiously, her heart curiously heavy because of him.
But the child lifted his uncanny blue eyes.
"I couldn't possibly go before the Derby, Mother," he said. "I couldn't possibly."
"Why not?" she said, her voice becoming heavy when she was opposed.
"Why not? You can still go from the seaside to see the Derby with your Uncle Oscar, if that's what you wish. No need for you to wait here. Besides, I think you care too much about these races. It's a bad sign. My family has been a gambling family, and you won't know until you grow up how much damage it has done. But it has done damage. I shall have to send Bassett away and ask Uncle Oscar not to talk racing to you, unless you promise to be reasonable about it. Go away to the seaside and forget it. You're all nerves."
"I'll do what you like, Mother, so long as you don't send me away till after the Derby," the boy said.
"Send you away from where? Just from this house?"
"Yes,"
he said, gazing at her.
"Why, you curious child, what makes you care about this house so much suddenly? I never knew you to love it."
He gazed at her without speaking. He had a secret within a secret, something he had not divulged even to Bassett or to his Uncle Oscar. But his mother, after standing undecidedly and a little bit sullen for some moments, said,
"Very well, then. Don't go to the seaside till after the Derby if you don't wish to. But promise me you won't think so much about horse racing and events, as you call them."
"Oh, no," said the boy, casually. "I won't think much about them, Mother. You needn't worry."
"I wouldn't worry, Mother, if I were you."
"If you were me and I were you," said his mother, "I wonder what we should do."
"But you needn't worry, Mother, don't you?"
the boy repeated.
I should be awfully glad to know it, she said wearily.
Oh, well, you can, you know. I mean, you ought to know you needn't worry, he insisted.
Ought I? Well, then I'll see about it, she said.
Paul's secret of secrets was his wooden horse, that which had no name. Since he was emancipated from a nurse and a nursery governess, he had had his rocking horse removed to his bedroom at the top of the house.
"Surely you're too big for a rocking horse," his mother had remonstrated. "Well, you see, Mother, till I can have a real horse, I like to have some sort of animal about,"
had been his quaint answer.
"Do you feel he keeps you company?" she laughed.
"Oh, yes, he's very good. He always keeps me company when I'm there," said Paul.
So the horse, rather shabby, stood in an arrested prance in the boy's bedroom. The Derby was drawing near, and the boy grew more and more tense. He hardly heard what was spoken to him. He was very frail, and his eyes were really uncanny. His mother had sudden strange seizures of uneasiness about him. Sometimes, for half an hour, she would feel a sudden anxiety about him that was almost anguish. She wanted to rush to him at once and know he was safe. Two nights before the Derby, she was at a big party in town when one of her rushes of anxiety about her boy, her firstborn, gripped her heart till she could hardly speak. She fought with the feeling, might and main, for she believed in common sense. But it was too strong. She had to leave the dance and go downstairs to telephone to the country. The children's nursery governess was terribly surprised and startled at being rung up in the night.
"Are the children all right, Miss Wilmot?"
"Oh, yes, they are quite all right."
"Master Paul, is he all right?"
"He went to bed right as a trivet. Shall I run up and look at him?"
"No,"
said Paul's mother reluctantly.
"No, don't trouble. It's all right. Don't sit up. We shall be home fairly soon."
She did not want her son's privacy intruded upon.
"Very good," said the governess.
It was about 1 o'clock when Paul's mother and father drove up to their house. All was still. Paul's mother went to her room and slipped off her white fur cloak. She had told her maid not to wait up for her. She heard her husband downstairs mixing a whiskey and soda. And then, because of the strange anxiety at her heart, she stole upstairs to her son's room. Noiselessly, she went along the upper corridor. Was there a faint noise? What was it? She stood, with arrested muscles, outside his door, listening. There was a strange, heavy, and yet not loud noise. Her heart stood still. It was a soundless noise, yet rushing and powerful, something huge, in violent, hushed motion. What was it? What in God's name was it? She ought to know. She felt that she knew the noise. She knew what it was, yet she could not place it. She couldn't say what it was. And on it went, like a madness. Softly, frozen with anxiety and fear, she turned the door handle. The room was dark. Yet in the space near the window, she heard and saw something plunging to and fro. She gazed in fear and amazement. Then suddenly she switched on the light and saw her son in his green pajamas, madly surging on the rocking horse. The blaze of light suddenly lit him up as he urged the wooden horse, and lit her up as she stood blonde in her dress of pale green and crystal in the doorway.
"Paul," she cried, "whatever are you doing?"
"It's Malabar," he screamed in a powerful, strange voice. "It's Malabar!"
His eyes blazed at her for one strange and senseless second as he ceased urging his wooden horse. Then he fell with a crash to the ground, and she, all her tormented motherhood flooding upon her, rushed to gather him up. But he was unconscious, and unconscious he remained, with some brain fever. He talked and tossed, and his mother sat stonily by his side.
"Malabar! It's Malabar! Bassett! Bassett, I know! It's Malabar!"
So the child cried, trying to get up and urge the rocking horse that gave him his inspiration.
"What does he mean by Malabar?" asked the heart-frozen mother.
"I don't know,"
said the father stonily.
"What does he mean by Malabar?"
she asked her brother Oscar.
"It's one of the horses running for the Derby,"
was the answer. And in spite of himself, Oscar Cresswell spoke to Bassett, and himself put 1,000 on Malabar, at 14-1. The third day of the illness was critical. They were waiting for a change. The boy, with his rather long curly hair, was tossing ceaselessly on the pillow. He neither slept nor regained consciousness, and his eyes were like blue stones. His mother sat, feeling her heart had gone, turned actually into a stone. In the evening, Oscar Cresswell did not come, but Bassett sent a message saying could he come up for one moment, just one moment. Paul's mother was very angry at the intrusion, but on second thoughts she agreed. The boy was the same. Perhaps Bassett might bring him to consciousness. The gardener, a shortish fellow with a little brown mustache and sharp little brown eyes, tiptoed into the room, touched his imaginary cap to Paul's mother, and stole to the bedside, staring with glittering smallish eyes at the tossing, dying child.
"Master Paul," he whispered. "Master Paul, Malabar came in first, all right. A clean win. I did as you told me. You've made over 70,000 pounds, you have. You've got over 80,000. Malabar came in all right, Master Paul."
"Malabar? Malabar? Did I say Malabar, Mother? Did I say Malabar? Do you think I'm lucky, Mother? I knew Malabar, didn't I? Over 80,000 pounds. I call that lucky, don't you, Mother? Over 80,000 pounds. I knew it. Didn't I know I knew? Malabar came in all right. If I ride my horse till I'm sure, then I tell you, Bassett, you can go as high as you like. Did you go for all you were worth, Bassett?"
"I win 1,000 on it, Mr. Paul."
"I never told you, Mother, that if I can ride my horse and get there, then I'm absolutely sure. Oh, absolutely, Mother. Did I ever tell you? I am lucky."
"No, you never did," said his mother.
But the boy died in the night. And even as he lay dead, his mother heard her brother's voice saying to her,
"My God, Hester, you're 80,000 to the good and a poor devil of a son to the bad. But poor devil, he's best gone out of a life where he rides his rocking horse to find a winner."
And now, second best.
"Oh, I'm tired,"
Frances exclaimed petulantly, and in the same instant she dropped down on the turf near the hedge bottom. Anne stood a moment surprised, then, accustomed to the vagaries of her beloved Frances, said,
"Well, aren't you always likely to be tired after traveling that blessed long way from Liverpool yesterday?"
And she plumped down beside her sister. Anne was a wise young body of 14, very buxom, brimming with common sense. Frances was much older, about 23, and whimsical, spasmodic. She was the beauty and the clever child of the family. She plucked the goosegrass buttons from her dress in a nervous, desperate fashion. Her beautiful profile, looped above with black hair, warm with the dusky and scarlet complexion of a pear, was calm as a mask. Her thin brown hands plucked nervously.
"It's not the journey," she said, objecting to Anne's obtuseness.
Anne looked inquiringly at her darling. The young girl, in her self-confident, practical way, proceeded to reckon up this whimsical creature. But suddenly she found herself full in the eyes of Frances, felt two dark, hectic eyes flaring challenge at her, and she shrank away. Frances was peculiar for these great exposed looks, which disconcerted people by their violence and their suddenness.
"What's a matter, poor old duck?"
asked Anne,
as she folded the slight, willful form of her sister in her arms. Frances laughed shakily and nestled down for comfort on the budding breasts of the strong girl.
"Oh, I'm only a bit tired," she murmured on the point of tears.
"Well, of course you are. What do you expect?"
soothed Anne. It was a joke to Frances that Anne should play elder, almost mother, to her. But then Anne was in her unvexed teens. Men were like big dogs to her, while Frances, at 23, suffered a good deal. The country was intensely mourning still. On the common, everything shone beside its shadow, and the hillside gave off heat in silence. The brown turf seemed in a low state of combustion. The leaves of the oaks were scorched brown. Among the blackish foliage in the distance shone the small red and orange of the village. The willows in the brook course at the foot of the common suddenly shook with a dazzling effect like diamonds. It was a puff of wind. Anne resumed her normal position. She spread her knees and put in her lap a handful of hazelnuts, whitey-green leafy things, whose one cheek was tanned between brown and pink. These she began to crack and eat. Frances, with bowed head, mused bitterly.
"Hey, you know Tom Smedley?"
began the young girl as she pulled a tight kernel out of a shell.
"I suppose so," replied Frances sarcastically.
"Well, he gave me a wild rabbit what he caught, to keep with my tame one, and it's living."
"Well, that's a good thing," said Frances, very detached and ironic.
"Well, it is. He reckoned he'd take me to Ullerton Feast, but he never did. Look here, he took a servant from the rectory. I saw him."
"So he ought," said Frances.
"No, he oughtn't, and I told him so, and I told him I should tell you, and I have done."
Click and snap went a nut between her teeth. She sorted out the kernel and chewed complacently.
"It doesn't make much difference," said Frances.
"Well, happen it doesn't, but I was mad with him all the same."
"Why?"
"Because I was. He's no right to go with a servant."
"He's a perfect right,"
persisted Frances, very just and cold.
"No, he hasn't. When he said he'd take me."
Frances burst into a laugh of amusement and relief.
"Oh, no, I forgot that," she said, adding, "And what did he say when you promised to tell me?"
"He laughed and said, 'She won't fret her fat over that.'"
"And she won't,"
sniffed Frances. There was silence. The common, with its sere blonde-headed thistles, its heaps of silent bramble, its brown-husked gorse in the glare of sunshine, seemed visionary. Across the brook began the immense pattern of agriculture, white checkering of barley stubble, brown squares of wheat, khaki patches of pasture, red stripes of fallow, with the woodland and the tiny village dark, like ornaments, leading away to the distance, right to the hills, where the check pattern grew smaller and smaller, till, in the blackish haze of heat, far off, only the tiny white squares of barley stubble showed distinct.
"Hey, I say, he has a rabbit hole," cried Anne suddenly. "Should we watch if one comes out? You won't have to fidget, you know."
The two girls sat perfectly still. Frances watched certain objects in her surroundings. They had a peculiar, unfriendly look about them. The weight of greenish elderberries on their purpling stalks, the twinkling of the yellowing crabapples that clustered high up in the hedge against the sky, the exhausted, limp leaves of the primroses lying flat in the hedge bottom. All looked strange to her. Then her eyes caught a movement. A mole was moving silently over the warm red soil, nosing, shuffling hither and thither, flat and dark as a shadow, shifting about, and as suddenly brisk and as silent, like a very ghost of joie de vivre. Frances started, from habit was about to call on Anne to kill the little pest. But today, her lethargy of unhappiness was too much for her.
She watched the little brute, paddling, snuffing, touching things to discover them, running in blindness, delighted to ecstasy by the sunlight and the hot strange things that caressed its belly and its nose. She felt a keen pity for the little creature.
"Hey, your friend, look there! It's a mole!"
Anne was on her feet, standing, watching the dark, unconscious beast. Frances frowned with anxiety.
"It doesn't run off, does it?"
said the young girl softly. Then she stealthily approached the creature. The mole paddled, fumbling away. In an instant, Anne put her foot upon it, not too heavily. Frances could see the struggling, swimming movement of the little pink hands of the brute, the twisting and twitching of its pointed nose as it wrestled under the sole of the boot.
"It does wriggle,"
said the bonny girl, knitting her brows in a frown at the eerie sensation. Then she bent down to look at her trap. Frances could now see, beyond the edge of the boot sole, the heaving of the velvet shoulders, the pitiful turning of the sightless face, the frantic rowing of the flat pink hands.
"Kill the thing,"
she said, turning away her face.
"Oh, I'm not," laughed Anne, shrinking. "You can if you like."
"I don't like," said Frances, with quiet intensity. After several dabbling attempts, Anne succeeded in picking up the little animal by the scruff of its neck. It threw back its head, flung its long blind snout from side to side, the mouth open in a peculiar oblong, with tiny pinkish teeth at the edge. The blind, frantic mouth gaped and writhed. The body, heavy and clumsy, hung, scarcely moving.
"Isn't it a snappy little thing?"
observed Anne, twisting to avoid the teeth.
"Well, what are you going to do with it?"
asked Frances sharply.
"It's got to be killed. Look at the damage they do. I shall take it home and let Daddy or somebody kill it. I'm not going to let it go."
She swaddled the creature clumsily in her pocket handkerchief and sat down beside her sister. There was an interval of silence during which Anne combated the efforts of the mole.
"You've not had much to say about Jimmy this time. Did you see him often in Liverpool?"
Anne asked suddenly.
"Once or twice," replied Frances, giving no sign of how the question troubled her.
"And aren't you sweet on him any more, then?"
"I should think I'm not, seeing that he's engaged."
"Engaged? Jimmy Barris? Well, of all things, I never thought he'd get engaged."
"Why not? He's as much right as anybody else," snapped Frances.
Anne was fumbling with the mole.
"'Appen so," she said at length. "But I never thought Jimmy would, though."
"Why not?" snapped Frances.
"I don't know. This blessed mole, it's not keeping still. Who's he got engaged to?"
"How should I know?"
"Well, I thought you'd ask him. You've known him long enough. I should think he thought he'd get engaged now he's a doctor of chemistry."
Frances laughed in spite of herself.
"What's that got to do with it?" she asked.
"I'm sure it's got a lot. He'll want to feel somebody now, so he's got engaged. Hey, stop it! Go in!"
But at this juncture, the mole almost succeeded in wriggling clear. It wrestled and twisted frantically, waved its pointed blind head, its mouth standing open like a little shaft, its big wrinkled hands spread out.
"Go in with you!"
urged Anne, poking the little creature with her forefinger, trying to get it back into the handkerchief. Suddenly, the mouth turned like a spark on her finger.
"Oh!" she cried. "He's bit me!"
She dropped him to the floor. Dazed, the blind creature fumbled around. Frances felt like shrieking. She expected him to dart away in a flash like a mouse. And there he remained, groping. She wanted to cry to him to be gone. Anne, in a sudden decision of wrath, caught up her sister's walking cane. With one blow, the mole was dead. Frances was startled and shocked. One moment, the little wretch was fussing in the heat, and the next, it lay like a little bag, inert and black, not a struggle, scarce a quiver.
"It is dead," Frances said breathlessly.
Anne took her finger from her mouth, looked at the tiny pinpricks, and said,
"Yes, he is, and I'm glad. They're vicious little nuisances, moles are."
With which her wrath vanished. She picked up the dead animal.
"Hasn't he got a beautiful skin?"
she mused, stroking the fur with her forefinger, then with her cheek.
"Mind," said Frances sharply. "You'll have the blood on your skirt."
One ruby drop of blood hung on the small snout, ready to fall. Anne shook it off to some harebells. Frances suddenly became calm. In that moment, grown up.
"I suppose they have to be killed," she said, and a certain rather dreary indifference succeeded to her grief.
The twinkling crabapples, the glittering of the brilliant willows, now seemed to her trifling, scarcely worth the notice. Something had died in her, so that things lost their poignancy. She was calm, indifference overlying her quiet sadness. Rising, she walked down to the brook course.
"Here, wait for me,"
Anne cried, coming tumbling after. Frances stood on the bridge, looking at the red mud trodden into pockets by the feet of cattle. There was not a drain of water left, but everything smelled green, succulent. Why did she care so little for Anne, who was so fond of her? She asked herself. Why did she care so little for anyone? She did not know, but she felt a rather stubborn pride in her isolation and indifference. They entered a field where stooks of barley stood in rows, the straight blonde tresses of the corn streaming onto the ground. The stubble was bleached by the intense summer, so that the expanse glared white. The next field was sweet and soft with a second crop of seeds, thin, straggling clover whose little pink knobs rested prettily in the dark green. The scent was faint and sickly. The girls came up in a single file, Frances leading. Near the gate, a young man was mowing, with the scythe, some fodder for the afternoon feed of the cattle. As he saw the girls, he left off working and waited in an aimless kind of way. Frances was dressed in white muslin, and she walked with dignity, detached and forgetful. Her lack of agitation, her simple, unheeding advance, made him nervous. She had loved the far-off Jimmy for 5 years, having had in return his half-measures. This man only affected her slightly. Tom was of medium stature, energetic in build. His smooth, fair-skinned face was burned red, not brown, by the sun, and this ruddiness enhanced his appearance of good humor and easiness. Being a year older than Frances, he would have courted her long ago had she been so inclined. As it was, he had gone his uneventful way amiably, chatting with many a girl, but remaining unattached, free of trouble for the most part. Only he knew he wanted a woman. He hitched his trousers just a trifle self-consciously as the girls approached. Frances was a rare, delicate kind of being, whom he realized with a queer and delicious stimulation in his veins. She gave him a slight sense of suffocation. Somehow, this morning, she affected him more than usual. She was dressed in white. He, however, being matter-of-fact in his mind, did not realize. His feelings had never become conscious, purposive. Frances knew what she was about. Tom was ready to love her as soon as she would show him. Now that she could not have Jimmy, she did not poignantly care. Still, she would have something. If she could not have the best, Jimmy, whom she knew to be something of a snob, she would have the second best, Tom. She advanced rather indifferently.
"You're back, then," said Tom.
She marked the touch of uncertainty in his voice.
"No," she laughed, "I'm still in Liverpool."
And the undertone of intimacy made him burn.
"This isn't you, then?"
he asked. Her heart leapt up in approval. She looked in his eyes and for a second was with him.
"Why, what do you think?" she laughed.
He lifted his hat from his head with a distracted little gesture. She liked him, his quaint ways, his humor, his ignorance, and his slow masculinity.
"Here, look here, Tom Smedley," broke in Anne.
"A Moudawarp. Did you find it dead?" he asked.
"No, it bit me," said Anne.
"Oh, aye. And that got your rag out, did it?"
"No, it didn't," Anne scolded sharply. "Such language."
"Oh, what's up with it?"
"I can't bear you to talk broad."
"Can't you?"
He glanced at Frances. "It isn't nice," said Frances. She did not care, really. The vulgar speech jarred on her as a rule. Jimmy was a gentleman. But Tom's manner of speech did not matter to her.
"I like you to talk nicely," she added.
"Do you?"
he replied, tilting his hat, stirred. "And generally you do, you know," she smiled.
"I shall have to have a try,"
he said, rather tensely gallant.
"What?"
she asked brightly.
"To talk nice to you," he said.
Frances colored furiously, bent her head for a moment, then laughed gaily, as if she liked this clumsy hint.
"Aye, now, you mind what you're saying,"
cried Anne, giving the young man an admonitory pat.
"You wouldn't have to give yon mole many knocks like that," he teased,
relieved to get on safe ground, rubbing his arm.
"No, indeed, it died in one blow,"
said Frances, with a flippancy that was hateful to her.
"You're not so good at knocking him,"
he said, turning to her.
"Well, I don't know. If I'm cross," she said decisively.
"No,"
he replied with alert attentiveness.
"I could," she added harder, "if it was necessary."
He was slow to feel her difference.
"And don't you consider it necessary?"
he asked with misgiving.
"Well, is it?"
she said, looking at him steadily, coldly.
"I reckon it is,"
he replied, looking away, but standing stubborn. She laughed quickly.
"But it isn't necessary for me," she said, with slight contempt.
"Yes, that's quite true,"
he answered. She laughed in a shaky fashion.
"I know it is,"
she said, and there was an awkward pause.
"Why, would you like me to kill moles, then?"
she asked tentatively after a while.
"Well, they do us a lot of damage,"
he said, standing firm on his own ground, angered.
"Well, I'll see the next time I come across one,"
she promised defiantly. Their eyes met, and she sank before him, her pride troubled. He felt uneasy and triumphant and baffled, as if fate had gripped him. She smiled as she departed.
"Well,"
said Anne, as the sisters went through the wheat stubble.
"I don't know what you two's been jawing about, I'm sure."
"Don't you?" laughed Frances significantly.
"No, I don't. But at any rate, Tom Smedley's a good deal better to my thinking than Jimmy. So there. And nicer."
"Perhaps he is," said Frances coldly. And the next day, after a secret, persistent hunt, she found another mole playing in the heat. She killed it. And in the evening, when Tom came to the gate to smoke his pipe after supper, she took him the dead creature.
"Here you are, then," she said.
"Did you catch it?"
he replied, taking the velvet corpse into his fingers and examining it minutely. This was to hide his trepidation.
"Did you think I couldn't?"
she asked, her face very near his.
"Nay, I didn't know."
She laughed in his face, a strange little laugh that caught her breath, all agitation and tears and recklessness of desire. He looked frightened and upset. She put her hand to his arm.
"Shall you go out with me?"
he asked in a difficult, troubled tone. She turned her face away with a shaky laugh. The blood came up in him, strong, overmastering. He resisted it, but it drove him down, and he was carried away. Seeing the winsome, frail nape of her neck, fierce love came upon him for her, and tenderness.
"We shall have to tell your mother,"
he said, and he stood, suffering, resisting his passion for her.
Yes, she replied in a dead voice. But there was a thrill of pleasure in this death.
And those are our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed The Rocking Horse Winner and Second Choice by D.H. Lawrence. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.